History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've learned over the years is that really, they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then invest a little time to patiently listen as memories that may have been buried for decades start coming to life again. The idea behind this show is simply to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really do end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The man we have the privilege of hearing from today is 97 years old, but he sure doesn't sound like it. He survived the Battle of the Bulge and one of the most challenging elements of it, the Siege of Bastogne, while serving with the 101st Airborne's 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment. We're going to hear about that, but as usual, we want to go back to the beginning so we all get a feel for who these veterans were before the war and eventually after the war, because all of that puts the life-altering reality of World War II in perspective for us. Dwayne Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico is our guest today.
You're born day after Christmas, 1924, growing up in Henrietta, Oklahoma. That's a time period, your childhood, where a lot of people had to leave Oklahoma because of the Dust Bowl. What do you remember about those Depression years?
You speak of the Dust Bowl. Now, if you look at a map of Oklahoma and Texas and Kansas and New Mexico, there's a bowl there, and that's where the Dust Bowl was. And then out on the peripheral was where the lesser. So my memories of the Dust Bowl are not of the Dust Bowl, because Henrietta is in the eastern part of Oklahoma, and we didn't have any dust like you see in the pictures. That's out in western Oklahoma, Texas Panhandle, up in the southwest part of Kansas, eastern Colorado, and eastern New Mexico. So if you look, that's just an area there in that quadrant of four states.
I imagine, even if you didn't see the Dust Bowl, the literal Dust Bowl, you dealt with the effects that the Great Depression had on families all over the country.
Oh, yes. But there again, it wasn't anything, because they're the neighbors and the kids I went to school with. We were all in the same situation, so it was nothing unusual to us, because that was the environment that we were raised in. And being 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense. I'm just wondering, for people today listening to this, if there's a kid who's an age now that you were then, if they might have their eyebrows raised a little bit by some of the reality. Can you give us a taste of what life was like there as a boy in Oklahoma compared to today?
Well, we had very little, and I was the youngest in the family. So eastern Oklahoma is hill country, and we roamed the hills, and we played. We gathered nuts in the fall and on. Now, one of the things that is on those hills that we did was somebody had taken a cable and tied it to a tree at the top of a hill and down to a tree at the bottom and put a pipe on it with wire holding a stick, and we'd climb the tree and they would throw that up to us. We'd grab a hold of the stick and swing out of the tree, and we slid down the cable to the bottom. Well, I see nowadays that here's all these cruise ships and Disneyland and every place else. They strap you into a seat and on, and they let you slide down a cable. Well, that was just play with us back then, and we didn't think anything different.
So you were ziplining before that term had been originated, and I'm just wondering, how about all those landings? Were all those landings perfect, or did you ever have an abrupt end to one of those ziplining adventures?
Oh, no, because as you got down, we didn't have anything.
And you mentioned you're the youngest in the family, so you had an older brother and an older sister?
Two brothers and one sister.
Y'all get along okay?
Oh, yes. As I say, they were older than I was. They were out doing their thing. So was my sister. So that was, it was a different childhood.
And it's been a few years. Did you play sports in school or anything?
When I got to high school, I went out to the football team, but I wasn't a football player. I was always back on the bench. But otherwise, our games were not organized. We played ball, baseball, while it was workup, and you went out into the field. Then you got the bat, why you had to swing. There was no standing there. You swung when the ball was thing. And if you struck out, well, you went the field, and the next man worked up. So everybody got to play. You cut a stick club in like a shrub, and with a carnation small milk can, well, you played, let's say, street hockey. But so you batted that up and down the street, and there again, you got on one side or the other, and we called it shinny. And if the ball was opposite team, got on the other side of the ball, why, it wrapped them on the shins and yelled, shinny. So everybody played. Nobody had baseball bets of this and that.
Well, and you talked about when you got to high school, and while you were in high school, in fact, just a few weeks before your 17th birthday, there was something happened that changed the world and certainly changed the lives of Americans everywhere. That attack on Pearl Harbor, do you remember how you found out what had happened way out there?
Oh, that was a Sunday. We were downtown where we kids hang out in the afternoon, and word come out, Pearl Harbor's been attacked. So that was the way we learned. But there again, we knew nothing of Pearl Harbor, and it was only through the newspapers. And I say the newspapers then were a lot different. And there was the local newspaper. Then there was other newspapers brought in. And I had a newspaper route there that I got a nickel a week for if I could collect it. And then from then on, well, of course, the whole United States then was on the same period of alert and preparation for war. Then Roosevelt brought in the four National Guard divisions for a year's training when they declared war. But the first draft was those that were 21 and older. And then when war started, Roosevelt lowered the age to 18. When you come 18, why, you registered for the draft, and the draft board, since we were seniors, and the last semester, why, they deferred us till we graduated, and then we were all drafted into the service.
So you turned 18 in December of 42, but they let you graduate in 43 before you had a report.
Yes, but I had to register for the draft to want to become 18 in 42.
And by that time, was your brother already in the service?
Oh, yes. He had been in the National Guard, the 45th. And my sister had formed the WAX and the WAVES and the WASP. And she enlisted, one of the first to enlist in the Coast Guard. So she served in the Coast Guard.
They called that the SPARS, I believe, right?
Yes.
And where did your brother end up?
He wound up in the Signal Corps in New Jersey. One thing about him was that as a lieutenant, well, he had developed stomach ulcers and became 4F. And they discharged him. But the thing was that he wasn't eligible for any medical facilities then, because they said ulcers, you had those before you became an officer, so therefore you're ineligible. But he said, I was an enlisted man before I was an officer, and when you commissioned me, you discharged me here and then immediately commissioned me. So I couldn't have got the ulcers in that 1 minute. So that presented a little bit of a dilemma to them. So they retired him. So he retired during the war as an officer and then on. So that was his experience.
And as for you, so you're drafted into the Army. Did you have any idea what to expect? Give me that journey from high school graduation to, hey, Dwayne, you're in the Army now.
All right. When I was drafted in, went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where I was inducted into service. And like many other people of the Depression, that was the first time I ever had two new pair of shoes at one time, an overcoat. I had all these new clothes. Then I was sent to Aberdeen, where I took my basic training. Basic training was over. I was sent to artificer training. And when that was over, I was sent to Fort Meade, Maryland, where they were modifying Enfield 1917 rifles, cutting the stocks off, cutting the barrel off, and shorting them. They never said where they were going, but making them shorter stock, shorter barrel, why, that meant they were to be used by a smaller size man. So we made up our mind then they were going to China through there to fit the Chinese or the Asians. We were a smaller stature. Then I went on maneuvers down in Georgia. Then I came back and I went to non-commissioned officer school. That's then where I went in after that, said, I don't want to change recruits. Send me overseas to fight. So I got put in the pipeline and then went to Camp Shenango and Camp Shanks and overseas to 10th Replacement Depot.
Did you have any idea how your parents felt about you volunteering for overseas service?
Oh, no.
And was that journey across the pond uneventful, or were there some memorable incidents on the way?
No, it was the usual convoy. Went over on the SS Argentina, which had been a passenger ship from New York to South America. The only thing there was we were shoved down in the hole with bunk beds, which just in between. We had to keep our life jacket and everything off. So while I was going across, very uncomfortable with all your clothes, all of your gear, and everything in that little space. I thought, I'm going to sleep. So I took clothes off and curled up because I said, if this ship is torpedoed, I'm never going to get out, so I might as well sleep in comfort. But one of the things from that was when I got to England, we was up in off of Glasgow, and the first thing was called Ailsa's Craig. So that was my first view of the outer world. Was Ailsa's Craig. So here, when the Olympics, I learned the curling teams, all the curling balls came from Ailsa's Craig.
And just out of curiosity, had you ever been on a ship before?
Oh, no. There again, you asked about depression. We didn't have a car until later on. And so never been away from home, which is many other kids. Henrietta, there was a couple of Italian families, a couple of Greek families. There was a couple of Polish families. So the ethnic there was Indian and Anglo-American. So when I got to the Army, well, here I met all these kids from New York, and there was the coal miners, and there was the kids from California, and oh, they'd seen this movie star. And so we was in this to all these new cultures. Let's say, military-wise, I was a replacement, and replacements were orphans. We went one place to another. You never was one unit very long. Some of them, 6 weeks, you'd be into another unit in 6 weeks and on. So I got to England just before D-Day, and was sent down to Tidworth Barracks, or the 10th Replacement Depot, where we were put in charge of the 50 caliber anti-aircraft machine gun for base defense. The only thing is, it was inoperable and no ammunition, but we manned it 24 hours a day for 3 or 4 months.
So 50 caliber machine gun, but no ammunition, yet you guys are manning it knowing there's nothing you can do if something comes your way.
Yes. So they just put one of us on, and that was it.
Did that trouble you at all, that reality?
Oh, no. Have you ever heard of Colonel Killian? Mm-hmm. Well, he was commander of the 10th Replacement Depot while we were there, which was a brutal brig. A couple of men died in the brig from mistreatment. So if you've never run across the history of the 10th Replacement Depot and Colonel Killian and his subsequent court-martial trial, well, you need to look it up.
Well, I'm guessing most of the people listening aren't familiar with that. You want to give us your nutshell version of what unfolded there?
If you came in late from a pass, why, he was taken to the brig, and he put you up for court-martial for desertion. After the war, he was nominated to be a general. And one of the men who had been in the brig saw it, and he went to his congressman, and the congressman went to the president, and Truman would not approve his promotion. At that time, when the injured come back to England and then they were reassigned, why, they came through the depot. It was just like somebody grocery shopping. The divisions in Normandy, why, they sent in their list for so many infantrymen or mortarmen, artillery, whatever units they missed, and they filled their order and sent them to Normandy. Well, the casualties in Normandy were infantry, which is in any combat. They ran short of infantry, and England was full of troops, signal, quartermaster, all the different support units. So they come through like 10th Replacement Depot, and they sent men down to Salisbury Plains, Tidworth Barracks, for infantry training, rifles, and sent them to France. And while we were there, why, that's when 501 officers came around wanting replacements. So I volunteered for the paratroops and went up to camp at Chilton Foliot, which was commanded by Captain Sobel of Ambrose and the Band of Brothers and on. So my jump certificate is signed by Captain Sobel. So I made my 5 jumps in one day and become a qualified paratrooper.
So I've got to ask you, only because so many veterans have told me over the years, the first rule of being in the military is never volunteer for anything. But you volunteer to jump out of an airplane when you've never jumped out of an airplane before. Why did you do that?
I've never been in one. Well, let's say this. I was in the cadre at Aberdeen Proving Ground. So I went into the orderly room one day and says, I don't want to train replacements, new recruits. You can send me overseas to fight. So, I don't know, the volunteer was just a thing.
So that wasn't the first time you volunteered for anything, because as you're clarifying now, because by the time you volunteer for paratroopers, you've already been in the Army over a year, and you're saying you could have stayed stateside and trained recruits at Aberdeen, and you said, no, I want to go overseas.
Yes, go overseas and fight.
Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, that was just the nature. That was just, I was in the Army, and that's what we would do. So I can't tell you why. That was just in my character.
It's time for our first break, but there is much more to come with 97-year-old Dwayne Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico. We're going to hear about some of the close calls he experienced while serving with the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment in Europe, and what his experience was during the Siege of Bastogne. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 97-year-old Dwayne Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico, originally from Henrietta, Oklahoma. He's one of the last surviving veterans of the 101st Airborne's 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment in World War II. Mr. Harvey told us how he volunteered to go overseas instead of a relatively safe job of training recruits stateside in Maryland. And then to become a paratrooper, of course, he had to volunteer again.
Well, that was one thing. It was in basic training. There was a kid from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He kept urging me. He says, let's join the paratroopers. Let's join the paratroopers. I said, no, why? I'm satisfied. Then they were volunteers, and we knew what they were going to volunteer for. So I had an idea of what I was volunteering for.
And you mentioned Sobel was your jump instructor, and you also said you'd never been in a plane before, let alone jump out of a plane. So when you had to do those jumps to get certified as a paratrooper, were you anxious at all? Was that a little nerve-wracking as you prepared for that?
I was apprehensive, but so was everybody else, because we were all kids. There wasn't any older people there, let's say men. I was 18, and so were the others.
And had you heard any of the stories or read anything about the guys who jumped on D-Day and everything that happened to them?
Oh, no, because they were in Holland and on.
So they had jumped at D-Day. Now they're up at Operation Market Garden. And one of the reasons they needed replacements like you was the casualties they'd suffered.
Yes. So I kept wondering when we were going to go to Holland. Why were they keeping us here when they need men in Holland? Well, after the war sometime, I was reading why I realized then, come to find out, that the two divisions, 101st and the 82nd, were under Montgomery's control. And naturally, with two divisions, he didn't want to turn them loose. When the Army, the U.S. Army, was saying, we need these troops back to replace them, he wouldn't release them because he wanted to keep control. So the two of them kept receiving casualties, and finally they said, you've got to release these so we can replace them. So that's when they came back. Then I realized, well, that's why they didn't send us up. If they kept replacing them, why, Montgomery was going to keep them.
I don't want to leave out anything that's important, but it sounds like we're getting to the point in your story where you're about to taste combat for the first time, and you're still a 19-year-old kid zeroing in on your 20th birthday when something that we all know about now was about to happen, but I'm sure you didn't know then that there's going to be this thing called the Battle of the Bulge. What was the lead up to that, and what did they do with you?
The morning of December the 18th, when we fell out for a morning roll call, the first sergeant called the roll and you had to answer. Well, generally, at that time, morning roll call, this platoon sergeant says, first platoon all present and counted for. And even though there was the men had gone into Reims on their own or into Paris and hadn't got back yet, then in fact they were AWOL, and he covered them up. But that morning, first sergeant called the roll, then he read the Articles of War on desertion and said, go eat breakfast, come back and pack your bags, dress warm, turn your bags into the supply room. So when after breakfast I came back, I had my cotton shorts and undershirt. So I put on my wool long johns, two pair of wool socks. I put on my wool GI pants, a shirt, wool sweater. I put on my combat pants and combat jacket. I had a wool scarf, my overcoat. Now, I was lucky, and I had a pair of overshoes, so I put them on. So that was December the 18th, and I wore those clothes. I had what passed for one shower until we got back in April on. But I, as I tell my kids, I don't ever remember being cold. Now, I did not have a rifle when we got on the trucks and pushed the trailers open, and we stood up there.
They're trucking you from Marmalone to Bastogne, and you're layered up, prepared for the cold. I'm guessing a lot of the other guys standing up in the back of that flatbed truck aren't.
That's right. Some of them just had cotton, their cotton jumpsuits on. Well, the weather there that day wasn't, you know, when we left, wasn't that cold, so they didn't prepare. So they was a number of them, yes, were not equipped for the cold. But I followed orders, so I dressed warm.
And I'm sure you have some perspective now on how different things could have been if you didn't. But once you arrived in Bastogne, what did you find there? What are some of the things that you experienced over the days and weeks that followed?
Well, when we got there at night, or the night of December the 18th, around midnight, a place called Mandy Saint 18. So I laid down there on a bare spot and dozed. And the next morning, why, the 1st Battalion of the 501 was the one that led out. But I didn't have a weapon. There was a number of others. So the sergeant said, stay here till I send for you. So I stayed there and was wandering around the area where we got off the trucks. The artillery, the 907th glider artillery, was digging in a gun. And as I walked around, there was an M1 rifle laying there on a pile of dirt. And I reached down, picked it up. So I had a rifle and one clip of ammunition in it. Then that afternoon, a lieutenant came by and a jeep, got a number of us that was there on the jeep, and we went out to a dirt road south of Bastogne to set up a roadblock. And there was a tank there, and I went up to the tank and rapped on the side and asked if they had ammunition. He didn't have any in clips, but he had a box of 50 rounds, which he gave me. So I put those in my coat pocket, then went out on the road and started to scoop out a little place, which was night. And about midnight, we hadn't anything, so it was a Belgian blockhouse, so I went back. And then the next morning, we received an artillery barrage. And when the barrage was over, one of the other men came over and told me, said, the lieutenant and Don Fair were killed. Now, I'd been in the Army a year by then, so I was kind of an old hand. But Don Fair had graduated from high school. He was an 18-year-old kid and volunteered, took his training, got to England. Well, he got, and then was shipped over to France, joined the 501st just a week or so before. So Don Fair was killed, never saw a German, never saw anyone, but died, and he's buried there in Epinal. Now, go forward, and when we was in Alsace, I'd been out on observation post, and I came back, and the sergeant said, go back up, report to A Company. They're going on a raid tonight. You're to go with them. So I went up, and the Motor River swung across the valley and over against the German side, and there had rubber rafts. They gave me a plank to carry up, so they put across the rafts, because the Motor River was frozen with ice, but they didn't know if it'd support the troops, so they made that rubber raft bridge across the river. And all the time I was wondering, here they got to see us and know what we're doing, why aren't they firing at us? But there again, when the time came, I was going to go across that bridge. When it come my time to run, I was going to get up. I was going to run across that plank bridge on. But midnight, they gave us an artillery barrage. Then it went slacked off. Well, I went across. And the lieutenant there had six new replacements who had just came up to the front lines. And then once again, kids. Now, they were kids to me. And yet, I was only 19. So he says, keep them back, because it was the first time they'd been in any kind of combat. So I strung them out in a line in the snow, and I told the first kid where the firefight was going on up ahead, I said, now you watch that man right there. And when he moves forward, you move forward. When he stops, you stop. So then I went back to each one of those kids and told them, I said, you watch the boy in front of you, and you follow him. And then I got back so I wouldn't be leaving him behind. So this was in the snow and the woods and the trees and the all the firing. Pretty soon the first kid come running back and yelling, "They're gone, they're gone, he's gone, he's gone." And I thought, oh hell, because there was in there, got these six kids, got to join up with the others, and they're not going to know whether we're Germans or American. So went up and started yelling that we was coming in, we was Americans, friends, on, and we was coming into where they were. So I got them back in. We were coming back because it was morning. I come across the foxhole and took out three Germans out of the foxhole who'd knuckled down underneath there and stayed and let us go on by them, and was still there when we were coming back. So then I coming over, and they were carrying an American back. So I took the Germans and said, "We'll take him." So three prisoners I had. Well, we carried the fella back across the river, the bridge, and when I got him to the first aid station, medic looked at him, says he's dead. So I took my prisoners and turned them back into the prisoner cage and went back to headquarters. And when I got back there, they says, "Hurry up, we got to stand inspection." So what stand inspection? And Captain Howard came by, and he grabbed my rifle and looked at it and says, "It's dirty." I said, "Well, I was on the raid last night." So he knew he had made a mistake and gave him a rifle back, but went on down the line. I never did like the Captain Howard. Number of years later, I was living in Wichita, and a fellow called me who was a sergeant in charge of the medics. He was in Wichita, and we pick up his daughter. We were talking about things, and I told him about carrying the wounded man back on the plank board that we'd picked up. And he says, "They brought Gulick back on a board." So I learned that it was Gulick. Well, then I found out Gulick had jumped in Normandy. He had fought in Holland. He had fought in Bastogne. He was in Alsace. And when he got hit and was killed, that was the last battle combat we were in. So he had, from Normandy to the last hour, if he'd got through that night, why, maybe Gulick's still around. So I remember those two, Don Fair and Gulick, one who was killed the first time he was in combat with no experience, and then Gulick, who was killed the very last hour.
And I could tell you've given that some thought over the years, and I guess my follow-up would be, is there something that you draw from that? That contrast that you painted, the differing circumstances or the different experience leading up to their death, but the fact that they were both two who paid that ultimate price. What do you take away from what you just told me?
Well, here is one boy in high school and the war. He didn't survive there one bit of it. So what would his life have been? And here was Gulick, who did all this combat and was killed at the end of his fighting career. What would his life have been? I know what mine has been. But what would theirs have been?
And I'm so thankful you brought that up, because really, that's one of the biggest reasons I do this show, because there were 406,000 Americans who didn't come home from the war, and I'm sure you endured some close calls where it could have been you. When you think about those two today, how do you see your own life in relation to theirs?
Well, that I lived a life, that I survived that. So I married, raised a family, and on. They had no opportunities whatsoever to do anything other than fight a war.
More than 400,000 Americans made that ultimate sacrifice in World War II. And of course, we really do honor them and help keep their memory alive every time we recognize those who were fortunate enough to make it home. It's time for another break, but when we come back, more of Duane Harvey's memories from his days in the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment, including Bastogne during the worst of the Battle of the Bulge. Surrounded with dwindling supplies and no promise of help or rescue, how did he deal with that reality as he marked his 20th birthday amid that scenario? We're going to find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a fascinating conversation with a resilient and certainly stoic World War II veteran named Dwayne Harvey. Originally from Oklahoma, he spent plenty of time in Kansas and has been in Albuquerque, New Mexico for the last two decades. At this time, 77 years ago, he was a 20-year-old paratrooper battling the Nazi regime in Europe. When we left off, Mr. Harvey had given us a powerful illustration of the seemingly arbitrary nature of casualties in war. Two men with whom he served, Fair and Gulick. One killed by artillery fire before he even encountered an enemy soldier. Another who made it through multiple campaigns before losing his life in the final hour of combat that the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment experienced in World War II.
And I interested too, because when Don Fair got killed, that was your first day of combat too. Does that weigh on you? The fact that, hey, if that can happen to that guy, what's stopping it from happening to me?
No. Same way as a few days later, there's a place called Sinnenchamps, and I was out patrol. The rest of the troops was in the house because of the cold, and I heard some shells coming. So I was by the door, and this is a stone house, and I stepped in the door, and I stood. Here was a door, here was a wall, here was a window. So I stood up against that wall, and the shell hit outside, and the blackout curtains with the shutters blew in. I went back outside to finish my patrol. The next morning, when the patrol was over, I came in. I laid down on the floor and fell asleep. The morning when I woke up, I had no feelings in my legs. And I thought, well, I've laid here and I've slept and they've froze. So I thought, well, that's part of it. But then again, to move and I thought, no, they've just gone to sleep. So I kept moving until I could move my legs and got feeling every restored. And the shell hit outside, and there again, they started up. So I jumped up, started to run outside, and there was a tanker captain who had come up to the door, and he was laying across the door in front of me. His left leg was entirely gone, and he looked up at me and says, help me. And I looked down at him. My thought was, no, I can't help you. You're done. So I ran on across the road. So later on, that barrage was over. I went into the house. The fella says, looky here. And there was the nose, the fuse cone of a 75 shell. And there was the shell over in the corner. The fuse had spun off of it. And right here on the door jamb or the window jamb was a indentation and right where I'd been standing. So that was my real close incident to being killed.
One of them. But just to connect the dots for people as they're following along, this was a dud. the fuse had separated somehow. I mean, I don't think that happened very often. That was pretty rare, right? So, I mean, the odds of that happening in the doorway that you're standing, you wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be talking.
No. And there was another time when we was in after the Bastogne had been relieved. That's when we suffered all most of our casualties, was after the relief, because then we were on the offensive. We was attacking. So there's one evening where the lieutenant came up, and we had a German Jew from New York who had left Germany after Kristallnacht. I could say brave, but I was going to say you dig. That's if you're below ground, you're safer. So whenever I come up, I dug. That was religious with me, was to dig. Uh-huh. But Koppel come up, and we went up because the report had been a German platoon was behind the lines. It had come sorted through and sifted through and was behind the lines. And the major wanted to make sure that they were done. So the company was sweeping through the woods to find them. So Koppel, he wanted to go up and get some shooting in. So I went up, and the machine gunner was there, and he didn't have an assistant, so he wanted to ask me to jump in and feed the belt. So I said, okay. So I got in the foxhole with him. But there was no Germans in the woods, so they'd cleaned them out. So the lieutenant came up and said, well, let's go back. So when he was talking with the platoon leader there, the had a platoon that was in that sector, the Germans had the place under observation because they dropped six mortar rounds in, and it was boom, 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 back and forth. So I survived that. When that barrage was over, why we jumped up and went back to the back. But the next day, sometime after that, one of the fellows told me that the machine gunner had got a direct hit in the hole.
So yet again, and these are starting to add up. I mean, that easily could have been you. If you were still there, you're gone too.
Yeah, but that was the way we lived.
And so I understand correctly. Your view of that is that's just the luck of the draw. That's what happens in war.
Yes.
And we've talked about getting to the bulge and the things that happened after the bulge. But there aren't a whole lot of guys still with us who can tell the story of what it was like to be in Bastogne during those days. And you had Christmas Eve, Christmas, and your birthday 3 days in a row. I don't know if you could focus on those realities, but you tell me. I don't know. You know. Tell me what it was like to be there and some of the things you saw or felt or experienced.
Well, I was in the bulge. I knew where I was. I knew what I had to do. There again, it was just like one night when I was in the foxhole, and I had a replacement. Young kid, again, was in there. And evidently, he was just coming up because I didn't know him. It took turns of every 2 hours being awake on. So it was coming morning, and I'd been on alert, and he'd there. And I told him I was going to take a nap. But I said, it's going to be daylight here in an hour or so. The Germans, that's when they're going to be coming down the road. So I took a nap, and he woke me up and was all excited that they're coming down the road. They're coming down the road. So I looked, and I could see the road was in defile, and you could see the heads. And he says, shall we shoot now? I said, no. Wait until they come out from that defilade where the road is there. And I says, then you can get a body shot. Well, before they got really in out of that defilade where the two of us could shoot, machine gun opened up on them. So that ended that threat. To me, yeah, that was just part of it. That, yeah, here they're coming out. We're going to shoot them.
And did you have any concept of what the big picture was around that battle and the siege and all that?
We knew we were surrounded. But there again, my whole thing, as I say, is that little sector right in front of me. I take care of my sector. If the fellow over to my right gets into trouble, I can help him defend his. I'll help him. Or if the fellow over here, his little sector there, gets trouble, I'll help him, because you're going to help me if I get my trouble.
So you knew you were surrounded, but you didn't let that reality bother you?
No. We were paratroopers.
I mean, I'm imagining myself in your shoes, and I'm sure a lot of people listening are too. I mean, if you know you're surrounded and the planes can't fly because the weather's so bad so they can't come and support you, I'm sure a lot of people would feel pretty helpless and scared in that scenario.
Well, as I said, we were volunteers. We were special. So if you're special, you do special things. And we had the attitude that we were special.
And as one day piled on to another, and it's not getting any warmer, and the big picture's not getting any clearer, same mindset?
You're there. You're going to do it.
And how about food? Did you have enough to eat?
No. But there again, that was wasn't starving. So you got an occasional that. Now, in that sector of sending champs, back behind was a you can call a chateau, was Il La Hesse. A countess was there. The headquarters, the division headquarters, came out of Bastogne every night and stayed at Il La Hesse on, because they were bombing Bastogne, and this was outside of Bastogne. So at night, we alternated staying in the foxholes at sending champs outside, and then we'd go back to Il La Hesse to defend Il La Hesse if that was taken care of. That's where I spent Christmas, was at Il La Hesse. Now, there again, there was all the colonels and the generals and everybody from the headquarters of the division there, and dining on tables, and we got a K-ration on there. And we would go back up to the foxholes in the evening and night, you know, not daytime. So while I was wandering around through the stable yards there, while there was a jeep there from where the officers were there, and I walked by that, I saw a sleeping bag. So I reached down and I picked up the sleeping bag, which was a down bag, and took it with me. So I had a down bag and I carried with me in the winter that I crawled into. So that was one thing about keeping warm. I still have it.
So I'm just trying to keep score here, if you will. Cold didn't bother you. Being surrounded didn't bother you. Not having enough food didn't bother you. Did it at least make an impression for you or make you feel better when these bombers could finally fly and give you guys some air support?
Well, it was C-47s and the bomb there. Mm-hmm. And so when they finally flew over and made their drops, why, yes, that gave us, we got some supplies now.
Yeah, and I've talked to a lot of the guys who flew some of those bombing missions, but the C-47s were probably even more important to you because they could finally resupply you guys again. Is that like manna from heaven? I mean, what does that feel like when you know you're running out and all of a sudden here it comes?
Of course, they were off in the distance, and you could see them. It really didn't affect us at that time because it didn't change anything of your life that day, because you was there in the foxhole in the morning when they flew over, and next day you were still in that foxhole. But you knew there'd been help, so that was... But it wasn't like they flew over and you were handed something.
Well, that makes sense, and I sure appreciate how real and candid this all is. Not a glamorized or Hollywood version of life on the front lines in World War II, but just how one young paratrooper really experienced it. Unfortunately, our time on the radio today is about to come to an end, but there's so much more of Mr. Harvey's story left to tell that we're going to make an exception and extend this conversation into next week's episode of Hometown Heroes. Thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.